Hi, I'm Alexis Ohanian. You may know me as one of the co-founders of Reddit, but more recently, a large part of my identity is being a father to my wonderful daughters. In my podcast, Business Dad, I hope to open the conversation about working parents a bit. You'll get to hear from a wide range of business dads, from Rainn Wilson and Guy Raz to Todd Carmichael and Shane Battier, to find out how they balance being a dad with a successful career. Business Dad is available now, so be sure to listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, it's Molly McAleer, and you are listening to season 4 of Mother May I Sleep With podcast. Susan, thank you so much for being here for Manson's Lost Girls. You like work in schools. We're not going to like, go too much further past that. But at first, I really wanted you to do like a school movie, right?
I know.
But the more I thought about it, I was like, dog, like this isn't like Susan's like a fucking like you work like you're an what do they call it? Like an EMT or something, like some sort of career that I'm not going to get most people. And also people could get hurt in a weird way if like you dug too deep into that shit mentally. And I'm glad we picked this because I feel like this is just better.
It seems like it was meant to be. I'm really into it and I was obsessed.
My deal is I just get really horned up for bad high school kids. Like, it's my, that's like my obsession. And I guess in a weird way, that's what this movie is. It's also, we were doing a lot of like true stories at the beginning of the season. I tried to derail that a little bit, wasn't very good at it. But this is like the true story for me out of all the Lifetime movies that we've done so far, besides Jodi Arias, of course. Because like, it's so famous.
It's very true, and it is about kids. That's what's crazy.
They're I know.
Like 16.
I know, and that was one thing that kept like... So if you guys don't know, this is about the Manson family. We'll get into a little bit more of that, but obviously I'm sure you guys all know about Charles Manson. If you don't, pause the podcast right here and do a quick Wikipedia because I don't think we'd be able to like shade in every nuance of that, but I will do my best to like... sort of summarize some things that I know. Lifetime also did a little bit of like smushing stuff together in this too, and the timeline was a little bit inaccurate, it felt. But I've always had like a it's so controversial, and I'm gonna say it's like Jodi Arias. I've always had a soft spot for most of these girls. Leslie, I feel like, was pure evil. But for the most part, I feel like most of these girls, I have a soft spot for them. They were teenagers on drugs with a charming cult leader. And then like, you know, like people like Leslie, an enforcer.
I think you're right. They were very young. It's so funny that you're saying that Leslie is the one that you think is evil. I think Susan is the more evil one.
Well, wait a minute. I might actually not be able to tell the difference between Susan and Leslie, because I also will say that this movie had like the fatal flaw for a lot of movies, which is that they cast a lot of girls who looked alike.
They did. You're right. And that was a problem. That's why I had to keep going back and being like, wait, which one was Leslie?
Okay.
But that is Kelsey Grammer's daughter, Greer Grammer.
Oh, no way. With Camille or a first wife or like?
Yes, with Camille. Yeah.
Oh, shit.
I think that's their adopted daughter.
Oh, so Eden Brolin is the one. So she's the one who played Susan.
And I think she's the enforcer.
Yeah. Yeah, Susan's the one I was talking about too. Which one was Leslie? Leslie was Greer Grammer. Barely recognize her. But I feel like Leslie was the one that was all over the book as the one that was like the roughest. Susan's dead.
Yeah, Susan died of a brain tumor.
She's the only one, by the way. Like, most of these women are still in
alive.
Prison.
They're in prison, and they're... actually, I was looking last night, and they're the one... They're the longest prison sentences for women. Like, they've been in prison the longest for women in California.
Yeah, and I definitely have, like, a... I have a bad habit of like sympathizing with the perpetrator, the criminal, whatever. In these cases, I really do. Like, I fall on the wrong side of the law and history consistently when it comes to, well, maybe not history, but I fall on the wrong side of that for a lot of things where it's like, yo, like, I'm going to give these, like, teenagers who are doing drugs with a grown, like, world-class manipulator that has never changed a day in his life. Like, till his death, Charles Manson was talking the way that he talks in this movie, except if anything, maybe even worse. And I don't know. Like, I just don't think these young girls had that evil in them.
I agree with you. So I guess we're both bad because I totally agree with you. I've seen interviews. I mean, I remember watching interviews with Leslie Van Houten, you know, in the 90s and stuff where she's changed. She's very remorseful. She talks about the drugs. These were vulnerable women who were manipulated by a cult leader and they were on drugs and they made a mistake. The hard part is when you have read the book and you've read some of the gory details and you know about what they did
right
at the murder scenes, then you're like, is that...
Oh, like, Leslie's the one who looks a little bit like Shelley Duvall. Like in certain shots, like to me
right in the movie,
like,
right?
Well, no, even like, oh God, Wags, stop that now. Even here, like, doesn't she look a little bit like Shelley Duvall?
Yes,
like,
she has a moment. She does in that picture.
Yeah, she has a moment like that. And I remember that face. And I feel like I remember thinking, like, oh, she's the one that I'm not comfortable with. But maybe I was young. And also, again, like, I'm reacting very much from a place of, like, when I hear news about Charles Manson or when I seek it out, 9 times out of 10. I mean, my mom's traumatized by this case. Like, I've never had my mom like shut down on me about a topic as much as this. And I think it was like, she was very young. This happened in 1969. So she would have been about 5 years old or something, maybe 6 or 7. And she found like the Life magazine with Roman Polanski, like in the crime scene with the blood on the walls and everything. And she saw all of this, and like, we're a little bit more used to that now.
Well, we're saturated and we have right. the internet. They didn't have that, and this was national news. They're reading the newspaper, and this was all that was on TV and all that was in the newspaper. And just the details were so sick and sordid, that creepy crawly game.
Right.
That's wild.
Yeah, it is wild. And like, the other thing too, and like, and you know, like, literally, God bless everyone that lost their lives to these people, because I think that, you know, with the exception of, like, very few, like, everyone is very remorseful about that. But they didn't... It was like six of them over a span of time on behalf of someone else killed about 7 people. That's a lot. That's way more people than should die at, like, the hands of, like, sorority girls, essentially. Like, fucked up sorority girls. But the time that they're serving was definitely, at least, partially on behalf of, like, him. Like, making up what he did.
Definitely. And they're never going to get out.
No.
They're never
going to get out. They
wouldn't
let Susan out. Like, she was on her deathbed, like, with a brain tumor. They were like, she's unresponsive. Like, we just want to try and get her dead body out of here, or her like about to die body out of here, so she can be with her family. And that was a hard no.
I just think that because of all the media attention and the things that people have associated with it, and you have to remember, they were not remorseful during the trial.
Not at all.
Carving into their foreheads and taunting people, laughing when they were questioned about the crime.
I have a lot of thoughts about like all of that, and like, I want to get to that towards the end of the movie, because like, I had some thoughts about like, considering what they lived through, like how long it would take someone to sort of really come to terms with what they actually did. In a weird way, I feel like it's like waking up from a nightmare and realizing that you did something like so uncharacteristic, so awful, so, you know, just incredibly naive, like on behalf of someone that didn't give a shit about you. Like, I can't imagine like sobering up in my jail cell, like really after all the drugs that they did, like probably 2 years later, by the time you're getting your full brain function back, mm-hmm. I would just want to die. And it's also very expensive to keep elderly women in jail. It's like to pay for someone like Susan to die in jail, like that's a lot of money. Charles Manson too. I mean, they obviously were not letting him out again, but like he was a huge, huge, huge expense to the state. It was something like millions of dollars a year to protect him personally.
Right, from other inmates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the amount of attention he needed. It's like terrible.
Yeah, he was a sicko.
You know what's so interesting is I heard though from someone who knew people on the inside that like he was widely viewed as a quote unquote pussy. Those were the words that were used. They're like, Manson, he's a fucking pussy. Like, he never did anything for himself. And I was like, whoa. Like, that is... But I guess, like, an actual criminal probably would look at Manson like that. Like, you got all these girls to do your bidding. Like, you hide out. Like, you're in protective custody. You have all these, like, weird girls writing you letters. Like, I could absolutely see other inmates, like, resenting him.
Yeah. I mean, that's really interesting. I think it's weird to think about what his persona would be in prison, because when you read about his younger days, I mean, he was in prison almost his whole life.
Yeah.
And he went to prison for raping a boy at a juvenile institution.
Wait, is that true? Is that what he was in for? Like, when they first meet Charlie...
He'd just gotten out of jail.
Yeah, right? Which brings up a lot of questions about, like, Linda's judgment. Like, I have a lot of questions about, like, a lot of these girls' judgment.
Me too.
Sorry if you guys heard me struggling. I'm opening a window.
Linda comes off fit. Obviously better than the other ones. But no, I think he was in jail for pimping women, stealing cars, going across state lines. But that was just one thing they caught him doing.
He raped a boy?
Yeah.
Oh my God. Wow. I mean, I don't know why I'm surprised by that, but like
he was a boy himself at the time.
Yeah.
Because he was in institutions almost his whole life. I think his mom went to jail for some stupid crime.
And his dad was like a criminal as well, right? Or like there was something psychologically wrong with him from what I remember. But I mean, yeah. I don't want to give him too much credit and be like, you were born in so much trauma, but like true life, like. This stuff is it is a chain effect at a certain point. It's like terrible. It's terrible.
And yeah, the traumatizing others. Yeah.
And also this like happened like over such an interesting period of time. So this movie follows Linda Darlene Kasabian. I'm obsessed with her. Now, if you guys don't know who she is, she was basically the one on the inside that she, like, squealed. She wound up being a part for the prosecution. She went in and said, like, she couldn't live with herself based on what she knew and what she had seen. And
she was the driver.
She was the driver. And her lawyers were like, she didn't want immunity, according to, like, legend. And her lawyers were like, you're not talking until you get immunity. But she wound up not doing any time, which is, I mean, it's great. Good for Linda.
She had to go... undercover, right? And witness protection.
Yeah. So they didn't, I didn't see, we don't see any of that in the movie. And I was like, sort of like starting to get into that. But
yeah, the movie ends. You feel like they could do a part two.
Right.
They're just getting into the trial.
Right. And that would be like actually that would have been a good Flowers in the Attic type arc with them, because they have paid a lot of money to make this movie. The sets are great. Like the clothing is pretty great. They have so much licensed music. It's like actually crazy. There's probably 6 or 7 songs in here. It's very like benchmark with the movie. And it's pretty great. So I'm going to just jump into this first. But Linda is who we're following. This is all from her POV. Linda is... I mean, I think she gives insight as to, like, what was really going on with the family. And also you get to see sort of how someone would get caught up with Charles Manson. But we all have to do some critical thinking. Like, there was some big mistakes that Linda made that I was like, girl.
Oh, for sure. But, I mean, she left home when she was 16.
I know.
What do you know at 16? She was...
I know.
Got married and pregnant. You know, in the free love movement in California, that guy left her.
Bob
left her. And then she, you know, ends up kind of getting trapped in the movie, it's by Susan, and I think she did recruit other girls.
Yeah.
To bring to Charlie.
Yeah. So, you guys, quick refresher overall for anyone who doesn't know about, like, the main murder. The LaBianca family also was murdered, and there was some strays, and I hate to say that, but, like, I don't know everyone's name right now. This isn't that podcast, but I'll tell you that. This is Manson sent people to go murder Terry Mulcher, and he was living at Cielo Drive, which was a very famous property. It still is a very famous property. I actually can't wait to see Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, now the Quentin Tarantino movie, just because it's not necessarily about the murder, but more about the time around that murder. And it's a fascinating time in America. I mean, I'll just read you some of this. So basically, he sent a few of the girls and a friend to go murder Terry Mulcher, a music producer that was tied in with the Beach Boys and at one point was working on a record with Charlie. They were doing a lot of drugs together back then. They even recorded a song of his, and the rest of the group, basically the Beach Boys, were weirded out by Manson. Dennis Wilson moved away from him as well. And Dennis was like, it was interesting to me to see, like, Dennis was an interloper, that he was, like, kind of with the Beach Boys, but then also in this more, like, cruddy, weird community. Because every time I saw, like, Charlie and his girls roll up to the party, I was like, if I was in Hollywood and I saw that, I'd be... I can't imagine a scenario in which I wouldn't think that was weird.
Yeah, where you wouldn't be put off. That's drugs.
Right. It's like, exactly. And like with Hugh Hefner, it's like he was a cartoon. And so him with 11 girlfriends was newsworthy, and but still weird. So imagine fucking Charles Manson was not charming. He doesn't come across particularly charming to me in this movie. But anyway, there was a revenge-driven motive for him when he sent the girls to go to that house, which wasn't occupied by Terry Mulcher anymore. It was Roman Polanski and his young pregnant wife, Sharon Tate. So this is a little bit of history on the property. A lot of people live there, like a fucking lot. It was built for a French actress named Michelle Morgan and then Lillian Gish, who was a silent film star that my film professor, who was known as the porn priest, because he was the first, like, priest to step forward and say, like, we should be teaching porn, like, as a legitimate art form. He had such a hard-on for Lillian Gish, like, the way he would talk about her, he'd be like, oh, Lillian Gish. And it was very obvious he was horny, which was so weird.
he was visually stimulated by her.
100%. And then it was bought by this huge talent manager. He rented out to Cary Grant. Henry Fonda lived there. Terry Mulcher lived there after that. And he was also living with his girlfriend, Candy Bergen. Good old Candace Bergen, Murphy Brown. Candace Bergen's also mentioned in, like, the first page of Helter Skelter, because she lived at that house behind the Comedy Store that I think Mitzi Shore owned after, and she was the owner of the Comedy Store, Pauly Shore's mom, for anyone, I don't know that much about the history of that, but there's this house that has, like, these string lights that's right behind it, and it's very famous, and they, like, right away mention it on the first page of the book. It's crazy to me they still have this up, but I think Candace Bergen had moved out of that house with Terry Mulcher from the Cielo Drive property and moved closer to the Strip. And that's where maybe they broke up, and that's where she moved after. Then after the, like, murders, whatever, there's a whole weird time period where it was bought by Trent Reznor of the Nine Inch Nails. And he turned the house into a studio, which he called Pig, or Le Pig, which is very fucked up, because that's what they wrote in Sharon Tate. All of their victims, yeah. So they wrote Pig and Blood, and I think that's very weird. And they were the last occupants before the house was purchased, remodeled by, like, the guy who originally bought it and had sort of been renting it out in all of these tragedies and weirdness. He wanted to tear the property down. And he did that. He called it Villa Bella. He changed the original street address as well, which I didn't know you could do. It, like, went from, like, I don't even know how you would say an address like this. 10050. How would you say that? 150? that makes no sense.
I would say it just the way you said it.
Right. So he changed it to, like, 1600. So this is actually, like, a personal matter, and I don't want to fixate on this too much, as it is a very like personal thing to me. But the current owner of the property is Jeff Franklin, who produced my sister's show Full House, and I just want to move on from there now. Before, just don't ask any questions. Where we are now, though, in this movie, it's 1969. Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski were living there, but he was out of the town making a movie. Like, he was in another country, basically. So that night at that house, it was Abigail Folger, heiress to the Folger, like, whole money ass thing. Like, she was fucking rich. Like, that was a big net for them. Then Jay Sebring, who I think was like a celebrity hairstylist or something.
Yes, he was.
Stephen Parent. And then this guy, I'm sorry, Wojciech Frajowski. You try better than me. I don't know. Interesting fact that like really actually fucking shook me today. Quincy Jones was supposed to be there that night, but he declined. And I totally forgot that from like...
Oh, wow.
Any of my previous reading on that. But, like, Quincy Jones and his family, like, they've been through a lot, dog. Like, can you imagine, like, I mean, we all know someone who, like, slept through their flight on 9/11, right? Like,
yeah, it's... I mean, to luck out and not be at that house, because that was an awful crime scene, and they violated those bodies.
It was beyond. And, like, and I don't know, like, if I didn't really live during this time myself, as I was 20 years away from being born, but Sharon Tate was very, very famous, like, much more than I think people realize. Like, I think that would be, like killing Jennifer Lawrence after Silver Linings Playbook.
Yeah,
like,
I sort mean,
of, like, she was having a moment.
She was known as one of the most beautiful women in the world. And I think Jay was her... She dated Jay, the celebrity hairstylist, for a long time.
I always thought about that, too, like, with this night, just, like, that, that uncomfortable extra layer of, like, you know, you're, for everyone, like, not that Roman Polanski deserves an easy time, but, like, oh, my God, like, it's almost like Nicole Brown and, like, Ron Goldman, like, what was he just a casualty, or was there something going on there? But it just is, like, it's beyond dirty. The whole thing is just, like, beyond...
Yeah, you want to know, and then you're like, oh, Roman Polanski.
And she was pregnant, by the way. I don't think I've said that. Yeah.
8 months pregnant. I wonder about Roman Polanski, though. Was he doing her dirty? Because he seems like kind of a scumbag.
Well, I mean, he there's a reason why he can't come to America ever again.
Yeah.
Like, he's a real, like... People argue that maybe that's what drove him to his madness, like his bad behavior.
I just wonder about that.
I don't think that's the case.
Yeah.
No, I think that, like, you know, it's not uncommon to see, like, a dynamic older man who's genius sort of get together with, like, the young, beautiful girl
hottest,
in town, you know?
Hottest actress.
Yeah. And, like, you know, who knows what that was about, but we do know that... You know, they were living very much apart. He was, like, you know, during this time, like, she could have been with him. She's 8 months pregnant. She's not working. But who knows what, you know, do you want to give birth in a European hospital or wherever they were? It's just unfortunate. And it's, like, I think everyone's worst nightmare, like, when you leave the country or when you do anything or even love someone, is, like, I'm not going to be able to get to that person. And... this Life magazine photo shoot that my mom mentioned to me sounds, I've looked at pictures of it, but I barely can just because I'm like, it traumatized her so much, even though I know it would be probably very tame considering like what I've seen in my life. It's like him standing basically in a murder scene. And I think that those are very odd photos to take.
I looked at some of those.
Yeah.
And there's odd photos of, what's her name? The Folger woman.
The Folger girl.
There's photos of her. I mean, her entire cheek is like cut open.
And is he in the room?
They show him. Yes, they show him kind of standing there, and then her body's like back there.
So how did he get home? So like, that's my question. Is like, while the bodies were still.
I don't know.
Yeah, because it's a.
I don't know. It's hard because he's standing there, and you see bodies in the background.
Yeah.
And then there's like close up, and it's just, it's kind of sad. I was thinking, I was like, this feels like a violation.
Oh, for sure.
You would see her her face just like, and then you just think, oh, what must she have gone through?
It's weird because like we've gotten more manners and less manners over the years. Like I feel like people would be very like blunt with the way that they discussed certain things or when they were like, we're going to raise the bar. But in general, we have less manners. But like people back then, the way that people would talk to mistresses or like, you know, whatever, like even like Britney Spears being interviewed about her virginity every week. Like it was like people just had less manners back then in a weird way.
Yeah, they think they deserve to know.
Yeah. That's so rough. So we open up on basically what's like a acid fuel orgy. That's like what the credits are basically. Then we see a girl in her late teens or early 20s waking up. She grabs a bag to leave. She's about to make a break, clearly. There's basically just a pile of like sleeping girls in various stages of undress behind her. It looked so dirty to me. That was like my first thought was like, oh my God, all these days out in a desert, like we've seen no showers the whole time.
They're camping.
So she sneaks into an office, she takes some keys. There's a newspaper on the desk that has a headline about Sharon Tate being murdered. She winds up sneaking out. George Spahn, who owned Spahn Ranch, he was blind, right?
Yeah, he was.
So he had no idea. And it's actually, they never really touched on that in the movie or just like seeing this sort of guy that seems to be overly relaxed in sunglasses all the time.
Or senile. I mean, who knows?
He's very old. And what Spahn Ranch is like, it was an old movie set. And it was like where they filmed a bunch of Westerns. There was another one that they had that was burnt down, I think, in the last fire.
Actually, they filmed this movie at the Paramount Ranch.
Really?
Yeah, because you can tell.
I've been there once, I think. It's really far out, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's in Malibu, and it's where they film, like, Westworld.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's, like, one thing about L.A. that you probably don't have anywhere you live, which is, like, fake Western towns. That is so L.A.
Yeah, so they filmed Spahn Ranch at the Paramount Ranch for this movie.
Fabulous. Thank you. So, we find out that Linda, she wants to go take her daughter, but this woman, Susan, is it? Is that Susan who tells her you can't take her? It's not mommy daughter hours or whatever. You'll see her at dinner.
Hold on. It's not Susan. It's someone who looks like
Susan. It kind of doesn't matter. Like, we'll just call them like, all I know is that,
it was, Patricia Krenwinkel, which is one of the ones who's still in jail.
Okay.
But she didn't get much play in the movie.
Oh, she's like not listed at all on the IMDb. Patricia Krenwinkel?
Well, that's the name of the person. The IMDb person is Isabel Schill.
Listen.
They look exactly the same. I mean, they both have brown hair and...
Yeah, you know what? We're just going to like blow through this in terms of whatever. Just like if we're listing some mysterious brunette, just go with it. It doesn't really matter that much. But we find out that she's been separated from her kid all day. She can't see the kid till dinner. And Charlie said the plan is on for that night. This time, Linda's not allowed to just watch. She has to get in on the action. So she takes Tanya from her, and Linda runs away. She pulls away in one of the cars in the driveway. There's a voiceover as she peels out saying that her leaving her daughter is the hardest thing she ever did, but she had to do it. So we flash back to the night before where all the girls were sitting in a car singing that bizarre rally song that they all sang. What would you, like...
Yeah.
It seemed like... It reminded me eerily of, like, the song that, like, Chris Watts taught his daughter. It's like, I'm proud of my daddy. Like, it was very, like, menacing. They're holding hands. It sounded a little bit like a Girl Scout song, but anyway, they sang this song everywhere. If you want to go, I mean, we'll hear it probably later in this, but you can also hear them on live video like footage from the days at court singing that. It's really eerie. So she looks in the rear view in this flashback, and she sees one of the girls holding a knife in the light of the headlights around them. So whatever, this movie does flash around a lot in like not a completely disorganized way, but it is a little bit hard to track when some of this stuff is happening.
Yeah,
like there's flashbacks.
It helps if you know the story already because it does jump around a bit.
I would say like I would say you might be fucked if you don't know about this. Like, because I knew a lot and I was like shading and everything. This might be an awful movie if you know nothing about this. So she gets to a trailer. It's her ex, Bob. I stan Bob. He's not great, but I stan him. Like, he's the best guy in this movie anyway. So he completely mocks her and he's like, oh, I thought you were all good with Charlie over at the ranch. And she's like, I need you to come get Tanya with me. This is legit. And he's like, why don't you go back and get her yourself? So then she turns the car around to drive home and her car breaks down on the way back to the ranch. We have no idea where she drove to, by the way, because like at one point she like pulls over and calls the ranch, I think in just a beat, and she says she might be in Texas. And that's like days.
It's confusing. Yeah, because she hops in the car and drives all the way to the East Coast.
Right.
Like, eventually.
Was that where she was?
Yeah. That's where she was from. Okay. Maine or somewhere.
Oh, yeah. New Hampshire. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So, wow. That's actually a lot. And this is not a girl who had money. So, like, no, I'm saying, like, gas money. Right. So, I don't know how
far.
But
she knows how to steal gas money and steal cars.
Right. This is one thing you got out of being with Charlie is, like, I mean, I would say, like, there's a little bit of, like, an exciting, titillating aspect that comes with all of this that, like, if I wasn't such a pussy, I would try and pull off myself, but I'm just afraid of all the consequences that follow. So we're gonna flash back to when Linda first decided to leave home in New Hampshire, 247 to 632.
I need your help.
Oh, yeah? What about your family?
I'm not with him anymore.
Oh, I thought Charlie was your savior. Christ, come back.
I had to get out.
Where's Tanya?
She's still at the ranch.
You left her there?
I had to. Okay, you don't understand.
No, I do understand that you took my kid and split and took my money, okay?
I need you to come with me to get her. I can't do it alone. Something happened. Something bad.
There's no way in hell I'm going to that ranch. That Manson guy is crazy, all right? He's a freak.
Bob, please.
You left her there. You get her.
Okay. I was desperate, scared. I had nowhere else to go. My only choice was to get back to the very place I'd escaped from.
You're not going anywhere.
Yeah? Who's gonna stop me?
You are 16 years old. You are not going to California. What is this all of a sudden? What happened?
Ask your husband.
What did he do?
Doesn't matter.
Linda, tell me.
He's just an ass.
He's not that bad.
Yeah.
You don't know anyone in California.
I'll be fine, Mom. I bounced around for a few years. It was pretty easy to get by. There's always someone who'd let you crash. In LA, it's basically paradise. Bob and I fell in love and got married. We scrounged around, lived on communes, but we got by. Didn't take much to make us happy. Then I got pregnant.
Where are you going?
South America with Mateo, I told you.
No, you didn't. I was gonna do that trip with you, remember?
Linda, it's not a vacation, all right? It's business.
So you're just taking off? What about me and Tanya?
I can score stuff down there cheap, all right? I have to.
You took the last of the money.
I need cash. Maybe ask your mom if she can wire you something.
My mom? I haven't talked to her in years, you know that.
They're gonna leave without me. I have to go. I'm sorry.
Well, maybe not that. So they're in a diner right now, Tanya and Linda, and a girl with a bob is looking at them, aware that they're a single mother and daughter.
Follow my lead.
Works every time. Follow me, little bird.
Marty, come get in the car.
Why did you do that for me?
Down to loose change, right? Been there. What's your name?
I'm Linda. This is Tanya.
Hey, do you guys need a place to crash? Hey, come to our ranch, Spawn Ranch, out in Chatsworth. You'll love it.
A ranch? Like, a real one?
Yep. And more. Drugs, guys, food, and Charlie.
Who's Charlie?
Everything. Seriously, you'll love him, and he'll love you, and you.
Okay, so wait, I did not do this clip service. So first we were seeing like a flashback to when she steals the car and she's dealing with Bob. Then we see her and her child at home, just for everyone at home. God knows, orgies, whatever, with Bob. It's unclear as if this movie is taking mostly place in like Malibu or what, because I know that like Manson and his girls really started in like Haight-Ashbury era. I actually had a therapist who told me that she used to hang out with Manson's girls before they joined, which was kind of cool and the kind of level I need a therapist to come in on. But I'm going to tell you right away. First of all, yes, Linda did get poached from that diner with Tanya. She absolutely was like a sitting duck. It reminded me, like, oddly of my mom and I don't remember many positions where we were in that, like, in our lives where we had, like, you know, $7 to last, like, 2 days or something. But it was, like, a relatable scene for me. And then she grabs her right where I have to bump on Linda being a decent person is when she's like, get in the cars. We have, like, drugs. We have places to stay. And it's like, she's holding a baby. Like, I wouldn't get in a car with a woman who can say drugs in front of a baby. Like, yeah. Maybe you can do drugs with a baby, but, like, you don't need to, like, that's not a selling point for a young mother. It shouldn't be.
No, but you know what? Just from having friends, parents who were in on the whole Haight-Ashbury thing.
Yeah.
Like, I have friends who remember their parents, like, sitting in a circle and passing around joints.
Yeah.
Two.
Yeah.
Getting a joint passed.
What was that documentary? They did something about, it was, like, about, like, his name was, like, David or something. And he grew up in the Haight-Ashbury era with, like, parents who were on LSD all the time. Sean. Yeah. Yeah. That was, like, it was, like, one of those documentaries that had, like, a little sizzle under it when I first really started to, like, watch documentaries. It was like mid-2000s era that was really popping. But yeah, so this is like the worst nightmare also of like what could happen to a single mom.
Oh yeah.
You know?
I mean, it's like all the wrong circumstances coming together to make her even more vulnerable.
What do you think? Well, first of all, your cat's name is Bob, right?
No.
Wait, I thought, who's Bob.
That's
from?
That's my nickname.
You're like, I'm Slender Mommy?
Yes.
Okay. So, Bob, what do you think about Bob?
Bob's cute, but I think he's just, you know, just like a loser guy who didn't take care of his family.
He's a little bit of a fuckboy.
He takes off, and yeah. He didn't leave her with any money.
Yeah.
So that's why she's at the cafe with no money.
Yeah.
He literally just went on. Was he going on a drug deal? Hard to...
Well, so we do hear later that he had, like, a big net that he got from something. He got, like, some sort of big payoff, which, by the way, the exchange rate or, like, inflation or whatever is insane, and I looked it up. I looked up a lot of inflation in this movie, actually. But, yeah, I mean, he was apparently a drug dealer, which I guess, you know, you can't be, like, super surprised by that. You leave home at 16, you do a bunch of drugs with someone, you have a baby. Like, all I kept thinking was she even sober during that pregnancy?
I don't know that.
How could you be?
And I think in real life, she was pregnant again.
Oh, really?
Like, when all this happened with Bob's second kid.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And that, like...
They don't go into that, right. Obviously, because that's not part of this thing. But yeah, so probably not. If you want to, like, do you think she was sober? Probably not.
Yeah, and I also don't know why I wrote in my notes that she felt she needed to leave the trailer behind. Because I know that they didn't have any money, but, like, why leave this safe trailer. Like, that's at least a shelter. But anyway.
She was lonely.
She really
was a victim, a vulnerable victim.
Because you'll find out later, like, she is so far away from her family that you wouldn't even... Like, it was really hard for once I realized, like, how little her mom knew about her up until that point. I was really shocked because I didn't think someone could be away from home and live that much life. But we'll talk about that in a sec. So they get to Spawn Ranch. It looks kind of groovy, I wrote, but it also looks like just a dump. And this is them doing their best to be like, welcome to Spawn Ranch. Like, it's a fun, horny, good time. Like, it looked depressing even pulling up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, like, right away, she's, like, having a little thing with Tex.
Tex, yeah, because she's love-bombed right away by every girl. They're like, you're the only Gemini here. Such a good energy. Which, like, how did they even know she was a Gemini?
Yeah, I know. I thought that, too.
I'm like, did her friend, like, call in her birthday? Like, I have no idea. So we meet Lynn, a.k.a. Squeaky, who... I always thought her name was Squeaky because she had a squeaky voice, but in this movie they're saying it was because she made squeaky noises in bed. And then, like, she's given the lay of the land. Basically, it's free love nonstop. Everyone takes care of each other. It's, and like, nobody, very...
You're not allowed to have, like, a one-on-one connection. You
no.
got free love with everybody because Charlie says...
Mm-hmm. Which, like, they did actually make it look doable to me. At a couple points, I was like... I don't believe anyone's being held against their will in this romantic situation. Like, it was very interesting to watch how that sort of broke down in parties. But right away, Linda's, like, weirded out by Tex, but that doesn't, like, make her not have sex with him.
Right, she does him that night, I think.
Yeah, so let's do the rundown. 8:30 to 9:07, just so you guys can hear from the horse's mouth.
You can sleep here. It gets sort of tight, and we don't pair up. Everyone's with everyone. Charlie says when you couple up, you act like you own each other. Where's Tanya's daddy? Are you guys checked up? They split?
Pretty much.
Yeah. Possessions, man. Here we don't own anything. Makes us free.
I like that.
People come and go, but I've got a good feeling about you.
So do I.
Tex looks like a big old hamburger. Like, doesn't he look like a hamburger?
Yeah, he's kind of lurch.
Yeah, Bob looks like a hot dog, and he looks like a... Well, no, Billy, Brian. Brian looks like a hot dog. The dumb one that gets good weed.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So while she's banging it out with Tex, she's like, tell me all about Charlie. And he's like, he's full of love, which is crazy because he was in prison for most of his life. And, like, she barely is, like, taken away by that. And there's no more questions asked about that part. It's just, like, Tex basically giving her the rundown. We're family. This is what it's all about, baby.
And do you think that Tex and Charlie, like, the guys were doing it too?
Right. Yeah, I think so. I think so. Because I
wasn't sure how far the free love went.
Charlie talked a lot about, like, towards the, like, his last couple of few interviews, like, it was headline news that he was bisexual. That was, like, the thing. But I don't think that he ever specified that. He literally was like, a hole's a hole. Like, I've done it all. Like, that he was very explicit about that in, like, a really dirty way. And I felt it was very odd that, like, the headlines were that he was bisexual. Because that has, like, a little bit more, like, agency and, like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
That's an actual... Whereas I feel like he's just... sort of doesn't give a
whatever's
shit about
there
it.
Yeah,
right, there's, like, probably, like, a lot of love in most relationships. I don't think he had that with anyone. So
yuck.
And it's weird because when she says that, like, when he says, like, oh, Charlie was in jail, he made mistakes, but, you know, that's not what he's about, she goes, yeah, I've made mistakes too. And I'm like, you having a child out of wedlock is, like, not anything that this man's capable of. Like, welcome to a cult.
I just wonder if they really had any idea. Do you think they all really knew that he had been in jail, or they're just using that to kind of like tell the narrative in this movie?
I think they knew that he had been in jail, but I think that there was also a very negative attitude towards the police.
Right. You're right.
I think that there was also like, you know, just like, well, what would someone really go to jail for? Like drugs, like, you know, I don't think they thought he was like capable of a lot of the stuff that he was capable of before he was too far gone, you know, or they were.
Okay.
So Charlie comes in the next day. He sizes her up right away. He bends down, kisses her feet, and then he's just like staring at her crotch, like through her jean shorts. And he's like, you've got a father thing, don't you? How do you know? I can feel it. And he says, no more fear for you, Linda. You feel that? That's you beside me. I'm here now. Everyone's doing drugs at a fire. They're talking about what brought them there. They all have like these stories that they think are like cute party stories. Like Leslie was a stripper and she met Charlie at a party and he was singing and she was intrigued. He was playing Tony Bennett's song or whatever. So odd, like such an odd choice and probably exactly true. They all think these stories are really funny too, which is like, there's nothing like funny, like maybe it's sweet or romantic or interesting, but like that's objectively not a funny story.
Well, they have twisted senses of humor.
Right.
Which goes on to be revealed.
Right. So basically, oh, and then one of them was saying that she was working as an accountant and before that she was going to be a nun. So none of these people were expected to wind up like this. This is, I think, a big part of this movie for me is like a lot of these girls were like middle class or upper middle class. Like, oh, yeah. They were people seeking something. You know, I don't know. It's really sad. So, Charlie comes up and they all turn into like a bunch of giggling schoolgirls. He says they're going to go out for a surprise tomorrow. I don't know. I was just thinking like Denny's or like what I like. I didn't think it would be. I thought they were going to murder or like it was going to be like a local underwhelming honky tonk sort of night. But no, they wind up going to the sounds of So Happy Together by the Turtles, which we also heard in Happy Face Killer. And I'm not thrilled about the use of it. We see them all dressed up and they arrive at like this patio type of garden party. It's at Dennis Wilson's house. We'll find that out in a little bit. This is like a networking moment for Charlie. And this was the moment that I was like, okay, I could see the like no one partners up thing working, because there was these moments on the floor where one girl would like come up to Charlie and they would flirt and they would like kind of kiss and then move on. And she would go to a guy. And I thought maybe he was like instructing these girls to go to different guys, but then you'd see like a girl go up to another girl and then like one just continue talking to him. But it seemed like a really like natural thing, and we will learn later on that he is sort of like pimping these girls out to his friends, but that's not what it seemed like to me in that scene at all.
It wasn't. I think you're right, but I wouldn't put it past him to have
I wouldn't
that
put anything
because
past
he was
him.
Trying to get his music career going. And there he is hanging out with the Beach Boys.
Yeah,
huge.
He did less to like unload a stolen Lincoln. So this is actually the party that looks somewhat appealing to me. People seem showered, clean, productive. There are great snacks there. The girls are like stuffing their faces at the buffet. And this is where I started to really realize like, oh, they might not have like food. They might not have anything
They're hungry.
Yeah.
They're skinny. And I thought that too. Where did they get those clothes? And did they take showers before they went to this party?
Yeah. So like there's like really only a couple of things that we get to see from inside Spawn Ranch. There's like the two sort of like tapestry draped disgusting rooms. And then there's a place where they keep the kids, which is like actually like a jail cell set.
Right.
Like it would be like the sheriff's jail.
It looks like a pen for animals.
Yeah, and it didn't really occur to me that that's where they were keeping them until then, but we really only got to see a couple spots inside. So, yeah, we find out... I will say that this is a spot that I got a little bit messed up about, because in my mind, Charlie was not living at Spawn yet at this point. Like, when Charlie was with Melcher and the Beach Boys and all that stuff, those were during his Sunset Boulevard days. And he was, like, at the, like, the clubs a lot.
Yeah, he was.
And I didn't think that by the time he got out to Spawn Ranch that he had any sort of, like, social pull or anything. It almost seemed like he became a pariah. Like, he just, like, went out there and sort of, like, seemed to be, like, hashing it out.
Right, because he wasn't accepted.
Trying to make something happen. Yeah, it's, mm-hmm. like, it's unfortunate, too, because, I mean, this movie is, like, it has that thing, a recurring theme for me as a person is when I see someone snap, I don't always think of them as just being a bad person. I think about, like, being nudged and nudged and nudged and, like, have nothing work out and, like, you were set up to fail and, like, you know, you think you finally have a break and, like, I could see that making a weak person with something wrong with them break. But it's also just, yeah.
It's very kind of you to think that about Charles Manson.
I know. Well, I just mean, like, the deal with, like, you know, Dennis Wilson, he's, like, fucking doing drugs with Charles Manson. He tells Charles Manson, I can make your dreams come true. The Beach Boys actually did record a song of his, and then they were like, nah. It never went on an album, but it is out there. And it's just, like, you know, that would, I don't know.
That after all Charlie had been through, thinking that he might make it there.
Fuck with anyone.
Might have put him over the edge.
Yeah, I feel like most people probably would be very sad to learn of that. So we see Linda staring, standing by the ocean. We hear her voiceover in a scene of her and the girls are running into the ocean. It seems very free. I'm not upset by this. So let's do 9:12 to 2002.
I finally found my home, a family that loved me. I wanted it to last forever.
They're just walking into the ocean,
holding hands. Of
ages past, okay. Unenlightened, the shadows cast down. Well, wait, no, actually. I want to get, like, a line of it. We're watching an orgy, by the way.
They're back at the ranch, so
I have so many questions about that as well. You can cut it off anytime. Hurdy-gurdy, man. Like, guys, out of all of the songs from this time period they could have taken, Hurdy-gurdy, man is what they have a big orgy to. But also, did they have a locate? Like, was this happening in a motel? Because it is, like, a 3.5 hour drive from Malibu to, like,
Chatsworth.
To Chatsworth. It is a long drive. And I know that we're not dealing with, like,
I think they took some artistic license here.
Yeah, I just was like, well, I mean, the girls are driving around in a bunch of LSD. And I mean, I used to smoke pot in the car in college. So, like, you know, people probably are driving around on drugs. But, like, I was
at
really
the end of the 60s. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know why I'm like, oh, Charles Manson risked a DUI. Like, I don't know why I'm like, I'm so fucking dumb. But, like, yeah, that's where my mind goes. I'm like, how did they get back sober?
Yeah, that's so bad.
But yeah, so they're doing this orgy to Hurdy-Gurdy Man, which was the most probably cringy, like, overtly cringy moment for me. I was really roughed up by that. So we find out that all of the kids are considered Charlie's to a certain extent. He considers himself the father figure. He asks everyone if they're ready to have a good day, and he gives them acid one by one. So
yeah, that was a crazy scene. And how they, like, whatever they did with the visual, like, they kind of shook the camera, like,
yeah,
took it out of like frame a little each time a person took acid.
But, like, that line went on forever. Like, it's all over Hurdy-Gurdy Man, or under Hurdy-Gurdy Man, and whatever. It's all there, and they're taking this, like, they're holding kids. Really disturbed me. I was sensitive about that. I was like, how are you taking LSD holding a baby? I was like, they're all gonna drown in the ocean. Who's watching? Who's the sober adult?
And then they're saying they made love all day.
But people made it, you know? Like, there are kids that lived, like, your friend. Like, they made it out on the other side. I didn't drown in the 80s, so
yeah.
These kids were fine in the 60s. So Charlie's singing to Linda alone in a room. And it looks like they're in a motel or something in this scene, but they're not. They're having sex. And then after, while they're having sex, he's basically saying, like, I died for you. Like, he's, like, acting out sort of, it's Christ role play. He's doing biblical role play with her.
Yeah.
Was Jesus a virgin? He died a virgin, right?
Oh, don't ask me.
I mean, sorry. I don't know. I mean, in the book, he died a virgin, I think. Right? That's why it was, like, a big deal that he was friends with the prostitute sex worker. I don't think they would have ever called her a sex worker back then. Poor Mary. But anyway, she spots a wall with, like, pictures. And this is actually sinister. So inside of I know. So inside of Charlie's closet, he has, like, Polaroids of every single person that's on the ranch. And underneath, he has, like, different descriptors written for each one. Will do anything for attention. Gives it up. Loyal. One's the enforcer. And then there's a picture of Brian, and it says dumb but scores good weed. Nope, sorry, Bobby is his name. Dumb but scores good weed.
And Linda's picture is up there, and it doesn't say anything.
The rest is still unwritten. I was like gonna say that it says daddy issues in a little bit, but that's not the way that this story went out. Like,
but that is how she was attracted to him. I mean, she...
Totally.
She thought, like, when he pegged her daddy issues, which now I think, you know, that's, like, a pretty standard thing to peg for certain people. But when he did it, she was astounded and amazed. And I'm just very curious, what were these stepdad issues? Did he sexually abuse her or did he beat her?
So they get to that. So her like first dad, her OG dad died, I think, or he ran away. It was like she grew up without a dad and then her mom got married to a guy that was like skeezy. But and they imply that he was fucking around with her or something.
I think they do imply right at the beginning, right? That's what we watched.
She's basically
she's ask your husband.
Yeah, because she goes, the mom goes, what did he do to you? And like what you can't see is that the mom's sort of like looking her up and down, being like, have you matured? Like, let me check it out. It's very creepy. We saw that with the Anna Nicole movie. Like, that's a very not uncommon theme in a lot of like in a lot of movies that we watch here and that I feel like I watch generally is like just moms. I, Tonya, was a lot like that too.
Yes.
Wasn't there that moment in that? But anyway, so...
So I think her Polaroid would have been daddy issues. I do, even though they didn't go all the way.
She says to him, she goes, what kind of person am I going to be? And he says, you're a strong person. And he says, no, I'm yours. Like, she says, no, I'm yours. So basically, like, she's already, it took no time. Like, this was 72 hours and she's in a cult. So we flash forward to current times, I think, at the ranch. No, because, listen, who knows when this takes place? It just happens in the movie. Linda calls and Squeaky answers. So this is when she's on her road trip. After she's been rejected.
She's run away from the ranch.
And by
she's
Bob calling. Kasabian. Yeah.
And she's calling because, you know, she's worried about her daughter. Kid.
Yeah. Thank fucking God. So the other thing that we should say about Tonya is like, when she leaves, like, these kids have, like, dirt on their faces. These are child... This is criminal neglect that what these kids have all gone through. So, like, the idea that Linda even remotely cares about her child is a unique concept in this movie, which is why I think we're supposed to give her so much credit. So, 2515 to 2920.
Why'd you bail on us, man?
I didn't. My mom is sick. I should have left a note or something. I just got really scared.
Where are you?
Texas. I think. Is Tonya okay?
Yeah, she's fine, but, it's just Charlie. He's freaking out. He thinks that you might rat us out to the cops.
Would I have left Tonya if I was gonna do that? Come on.
No, that's exactly what I told him. It's just...
you better come back quick.
It's getting crazy around here.
What do you mean?
I can't talk.
Squeaky, make sure Tonya's...
Starving.
Do you know what I would do for a cheeseburger right now?
Oh, and french fries.
Strawberry ice cream on a sugar cone.
What are you doing?
Bet you're not thinking about food now, are you?
Hey, girls. It's time to pay the bills. Go with him. Be fun.
Living on love didn't bring food or money, so we hustled.
That's your lifeline right there. See? Branches all the way to the bottom. That's good.
So I live to see another day.
Mm-hmm. There's other ones, too. They tell you all sorts of things.
Oh, yeah? Like what?
Well, which car?
Oh, crap.
The Lincoln. The Lincoln. Quick. He's taking a piss.
I can't believe they would throw this out.
It's not even open.
Charlie calls them the haves. People who have too much and waste it. We're supposed to take it back. Like this.
Table for two, please.
Right this way, smoking or non-smoking.
Hand in, arm in, arm. We go our separate ways. With our eyes we say goodbye. Our hearts will stay the same. Time is nothing, love is free. Life is living, can't you see? Hand in, arm in, arm, we go our separate ways. Hand in, we always are.
There you go. Looking so good.
Yeah, but cool. All right. Are we sweeting the pot here?
Looks like someone's about to be initiated.
Hey, Sarah. Come over here for a second.
Hey, girl. Listen, that's my friend Andy, so why don't you take him on over to the bunkhouse?
I love you.
Well, this is how you show your love.
Charlie, couldn't I just...
Hey. You're free to do what you want. Everybody here is. So if you want to leave, I'll still love you.
No, I don't. Charlie, I don't want to leave.
Well, if you want to stay and be a part of this family, I'll pitch in. But it's your choice.
That was classic Dudley Spa / every cult is like get you to say it three times, get you to like make you think that this is a decision you're making, but also you're fucked if you don't.
I thought you liked it here. Thought you wanted to be part of this family.
Yeah.
Do like you want to be part of this family?
Do you remember yesterday when you didn't have to pay anything to be here? Well, now you have to have sex with my friend Bill or you're making a choice not to be here. Like, very rough.
Bye, bitch.
But, like, he's got these girls committing Grand Theft Auto, happily dumpster diving. Like,
I know.
I will say that, like, this, the whole philosophy behind, like, there are haves out there, especially in LA. Like, everyone knows all the bitches Marie Kondoing right now have stocked our Goodwill forever. Everyone's also always known you go to the Goodwills on like that side of town on the west side. That's where we're going to find like the real good
stuff.
Go
to the Jewish Council Thrift.
The Jewish Council Thrift.
Discovery Shop in Beverly Hills.
Yep. Yeah.
And you get the good stuff.
The bomb Pyrex, like all that good stuff. Great book sets. Like,
Jewish Council Thrift.
Yeah. Okay. Because that's on like Pico and Olympic sort of.
There's a couple of them. But yeah, there's one on Pico. I forget the cross street.
Pico and Olympic. That doesn't cross.
It's not Pico and Olympic. It's on Pico. There's one actually now that I think is on Fairfax.
It's basically like Pico and Robertson except for like three blocks over, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's a very good one. That's like
it's
one of the best
furniture. Yeah, and they're obviously dumpster diving somewhere really fancy because you can see
the Hollywood Hills,
Bougainvillea.
Yeah,
and the dumpster looks pretty nice.
Yeah, and they were that is the truth is like this was a profitable way to live, or like profitable, a livable way to live, like 6 years ago. I feel like during the recession, everyone was like, eat out of dumpsters.
Yeah, freakinism or whatever.
But I can only imagine that this was crazy back then. So we find out that Texas brought a suitcase full of weapons, but they are going to need more weapons if they're preparing for Armageddon, which apparently now they're preparing for.
Which is Helter
Skelter. Yes.
Which is a race.
Yes, and that's in like Charlie's, that's like a interpretation he had from a Beatles song, is that?
Yes, right? From the White Album.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he was like, I mean.
Which actually, I just read about it, Helter Skelter is, I think it's like a carnival ride. I think it references a carnival ride. I didn't know that.
It sounds like a fucking carnival ride. Like, that. It's so.
He robbed us of Helter Skelter as like a happy thing.
As a jam. Yeah. Yeah.
It's there's still a good jam.
Yeah, mute Helter Skelter. But I will say, like, it has always bothered me to a certain degree that, like, such a dumb, cheesy name has been associated with such a gruesome crime.
Right.
You know what I mean? I'm like, that feels like when I first picked up Helter Skelter, I assumed it was about like 70s rock bands or something. I didn't know it was like, oh, and of course, like I quickly dug right in, but I had no idea that that's what it was. So the girls come running up and it's creepy crawler time, bitch. What's creepy crawler time? It's rough. 31:32 to 32:15, really short clip.
With Dennis Wilson?
Yeah, he's gonna be bigger than the Beatles.
Okay, well, maybe not the Beatles.
But famous.
Hey, pass him back.
I've already taken three. Keeps your energy up.
Steal whatever you can find. Watches, wallets, jewelry.
Oh, but before we go, we mess with their little picky hands.
How do you know no one's home?
We don't.
That's what makes it fun.
Ain't gonna take none of you.
Yeah, I mean, these people seem less self-possessed to me than the Bling Ring.
Oh yeah,
you know, and by the way,
these girls—they're having fun. They're having a good time. They were hungry,
but so they also went out don't for the seem day. Like they're in chart necessarily behind the wheel. Even though they are behind the wheel, taking tabs of acid, and I'm upset about that. They don't seem like they're really like conscious about what they're doing or thinking like we're gonna get something for us out of this. It really is this like mentality of like we'll see what we can get. And they slide right into this person's home. And I do want to, I mean, did you grow up in an area where no one locked their doors?
Yes. My parents only started locking their doors recently. Like since, I mean, after I graduated from college, which was still kind of a long time ago. But yeah. It's crazy. No one ever locked their doors.
Throughout high school and even in college, like I would be shocked if
my
came
door was locked.
Yeah. Like I used to go into... Just so, like, you guys can really get a frame of reference, because there are some people under 30 who listen to this. Actually, a lot of you. I used to, like, walk to my best friend's house after school. Her family wouldn't be home. She would still be at tennis practice. And I would unlock... I would walk right through the back door, do homework at the kitchen table for 2 hours. Like, my Nana and Grandpa's house, like, there was never a locked door, ever, no matter what part of town, where you lived, whatever.
Yeah.
So they get right into this family's house through a sliding door. I feel like now I'm like gonna lock my sliding door every night because of this. But they kind of like, they ransack it, I guess, but they're not being violent about it. They go through purses, drawers, the fridge. They take wedding pictures.
Well, the people are home. The whole point of this game that they play is that people are home.
They're sleeping.
They're creepy crawling through their house. This was the game that they used to play, and they're just looking for stuff, for money, and valuables.
Very bold. Like, they take stuff out of the nightstand next to these sleeping people.
Oh, yeah. And they're shining flashlights, which I do think actually happened.
Yeah, I agree with that. And, like, the last thing that we see in this house is that there's an older person in, like, some sort of, like, at-home hospice situation where they're on a breathing machine and everything like that. This, like, is a lingering moment that normally in a Lifetime film wouldn't lead to anything, but it does sort of lead to something later. Charlie's dressed literally like Jesus with thorns on his head when we get back. He's kind of, like, in a cross-like position to
with
a tree.
And, yeah.
Yeah, like, what... theater, like, what was this? I don't really understand what that was like. So he didn't need to go so extra. These girls are already on drugs, you know?
I know. I love that you are continually mystified, because it is all just drugs. Well, I know, I'm the same way. You're like, why would anyone do that?
Right. But well, yeah, I've done mushrooms, like, and I mean, I can imagine, like, day three of mushrooms, like, you'd probably be, like, losing your mind or whatever. But, like, and I guess also I'm not thinking enough about, eventually they start snorting stuff, and I'm like, oh, this is, they're on speed. Right. Like, coke or whatever. But, like, most of this stuff, I'm like, that would just make you lazy and, like, happy. Yeah.
You wonder, too, when you see this, like, what did Charlie believe about himself? I think he believes it.
Oh, yeah.
And
no,
that's
he told-
why he's so extra.
Yeah, he's, like, till the end, like, never broke character. Like, there was never, with most serial killers, even people that are putting something on, like, you get to see, like, a moment where they've let themselves go or, like, turned off the character.
Right.
And he's never done that.
Stop. I don't... what's his...
I think he just was a...
disorder.
Just fucking... I don't know. Like, I mean, I think... I don't know. Like, probably, like, he's probably a psychopath. Like,
yeah, I think he is.
But, I mean, you know, it's... It might even, like, psychopaths don't even really know how to use people that well. I don't really know.
He's more. I think he's very sick and twisted and more than just a psychopath. I mean, he has a lot of stuff. Narcissism, all
that's
that
like
stuff.
A psychiatrist has that in their office, like Xenu. Like, that's, like, the last level. They were like, oh, we don't even tell people about these disorders. Like, this is... We keep this... It's part of the medical plan. It's like how we don't know about the aliens yet. The government does. That's them with Charles Manson. Okay. So this girl's like having a seizure basically while all of this is happening. And they think she's ODing. They're freaking out. It's clearly a fucking seizure, which I guess could be part of an OD, sure. But it's just, she seems to have epilepsy.
Right.
Charlie yells at everyone to shut the fuck up, and he leans down and starts whispering in her ear. She comes back to life.
He's, like, talking in tongues, it seems like, but whatever.
Yeah, and, like, also, like, sometimes a seizure only lasts that long, but they throw her back in the game. It's a real boot and rally situation for her. And then Gary Hinman, who's Bobby's friend, Bobby, not Bob Gassabian, but Bobby the dumb one that I keep calling Brian, he comes by and they're having this like dinner party, and Gary is a producer friend that knew Terry Mulcher and like was in somehow. So when Gary starts to realize that they're weird, this negatively affects Charlie directly in a real way, like career consequences. So before dinner, Charlie says grace. He says, life is God. Birds, bugs, trees, the sun. Some people got God on a cross, leaning down, hoping they'll go to heaven when they die. But death doesn't exist. It's life, baby. That's the truth. How do I know? Because I'm a messenger of truth, and you're all here. You're my church. And then Gary's like, amen. And he says, yeah, amen. So Charlie wants to go right into like a music conversation as if it's normal to just move on from that. Let's play 3635 to 3814. I want to play this because one, it's there's a little bit of exposition in here, but this is a good example of like a normal person interacting with him.
I was waiting for you to say that. Yeah, exactly. A normal, like, right. What would a normal person do who encountered these wackadoodles?
I mean, the word I would also use to describe them, total wackadoodles and kooks. Like, they're a bunch of freaks. But this all said, like, Gary Hinman cannot be that normal if he was even willing to follow Bobby out, who looks like the reject family friend's son that, like, you would maybe try to get him a job at, like, a pharmacy or something, or probably not even a pharmacy.
Well, sweeping up the pharmacy.
Yeah. Something like that. But you wouldn't ever be like, you know what? I would like to meet this crazed cult leader that lives in the desert and knows one of the Beach Boys.
Let's go out to Chatsworth.
So 3635 to 3814.
So, Gary, you've been listening to the White Album?
Yeah, I heard it.
Those boys from Liverpool are geniuses talking about how there's going to be a race war.
A race war?
Well, look at the Watts riots, Gary. I mean, we got to be prepared. It's all there. It's in Helter Skelter.
Really? I didn't get that.
You say you want a revolution.
I do, man. You better believe happiness comes from a warm gut. I mean, don't you watch the news, read the papers? The blacks are pissed off, and it's all going to go down real soon. Do you think you're special, Bobby?
No, man. Not at all. Why you ask?
You're taking more than your share of peas. We are all equals here. But apparently one of our family members thinks that he's the prime minister and president of all the world's peas.
I don't even like peas, so Bobby, you can have mine.
No, that's not the point.
Sorry. It's okay, Bobby, it's fine.
Sorry, Charlie. Just feel your remorse, son, and let it go. You'll make it up to me later. So, Gary, I heard that your pop recently passed away. I'm so sorry to hear that, man. I'm a fly with the angels, right?
Thanks, Charlie.
Did he leave you any money?
I mean, there's almost something refreshing about someone being that transparent.
It's just crazy. That whole scene, like, with his top off. And
right. So he actually, that's also a thing. Like, people, do you remember people used to, like, do that in the summer? They'd, like, come to dinner without their shirt on.
No.
My uncles.
I mean, like, outdoor barbecue, right? Maybe?
So we had, like, a beach house, and, like, my uncles would, like, they were all, like, when I was born, they were, like, 16, 17, 18, and, like, my grandmother was very... just, like, white gloves, fucking very uptight. Like, they would be like, hey, Ma, like, because that was very popular in Boston, and be like, Ma. And she'd be like, don't ever call me that. She was very, so my uncles would try to, like, roll up to the porch dinner without a shirt on, and it was like, go upstairs. I can't believe he came to dinner without a shirt on. And
Get dressed.
And this is, like, granted, I don't know how they did this, because where they're living is so hot year round. It's always hot, except for, I guess, at night.
Yeah. They address the heat a little later.
A little bit later, but he's like, the idea of him not walking around shirtless is also crazy to me.
Yeah, you're right. Okay, so he's transparent.
But then, what's the deal with, like, I mean, he's not tracking, because he starts out the dinner by being like, you never die. And then he talks about right away, he's like, oh, your dad died. Is there a will?
Did you get money?
Yeah. And so, like, he also, like, throughout this movie, like, from this point on, you can't help but realize how often he speaks of death. And
yeah.
What did he buy into on his own?
The movie, I just feel like he was a lot more cunning and manipulative in real life.
I hope.
Than he's showing in the movie. I don't know.
Yeah.
What he bought into. He's. Yeah, with the look on that guy's face when he asked him about the money.
And the fucking Bobby Pease thing. Like, he's sitting there being like,
you're taking more than your
share.
Peas.
Yeah. And, like, was there a conversation? Like, what's a share? Like,
and
a
I think
spoonful?
They're starving, you
right,
know?
Of course.
And they're, like, growing that food.
How they would cook that. Like, is there gas here? Is there light here?
Do
like, is there anything?
Stove? That's a good question.
Yeah. So, we go back to the part of the movie where Linda's hitchhiking along the side of the road. And there's some action at the ranch. We cut back to the ranch now. But it looks like things have slowed down a lot. Terry comes down and he tells that Columbia is going to pass. Charlie, Columbia's done. They're out. He gets very, very angry. And, like, just think about the fact that, like, Terry's girlfriend at this time is Murphy Brown. Like, a very young Murphy Brown. It's weird to think about Candace Bergen's boyfriend.
A babe.
Yeah, she was a babe. And, like, he was super successful, too. It's just, like, I don't think that, like, the big guys get their hands dirty like this anymore. And it's just interesting to see, like, that he'd get really down and dirty like that and actually drive out to the ranch and deliver a message. And part of me can't help but wonder if that's, like, a drug thing, too. Because, like, boundaries get very blurred
Seems
in all ways.
So prevalent in those times, too. I mean.
So, not to accuse Terry of anything. So, basically, he threatens Terry. He's basically like, Charlie, like, you know, the music industry is actually hard. Like, things don't always pan out. And it's very interesting to watch someone have a hard time grasping that, because I feel like I've met people who are like this in that way, but Charlie is on his own level. But it's right. It's a quality that's not uncommon, where people are like, wait, what? Like, it's not happening. Like,
not for me.
Yeah. So Charlie starts screaming, do something about it, because he's pissed. He's like screaming at all the girls, and he's like demolishing a car with a crowbar. And then Tex walks up and says, look, we can make our own record. And just like that, Charlie swings to the other side, and he's like, wow, I've got a record. So it's like one type of anger to the other kind, because he's like, I'm doing a record, fuck everyone, we're gonna like totally, like, everyone's gonna miss us. And it's like, yeah, dude,
I'm a legend in my own mind.
Yeah, it's like to see someone go from, sorry, that's my broom, to see someone go from that angry to another type of angry was really a lot for me. I want to know what that brain is like. Emotional
dysfunction.
Yeah, I would like 5 minutes in a brain like that, and I couldn't do any more than that. But I would
would probably cross universes in a brain like that.
Truly, it's like doing DMT. Like, it's like, yes. Welcome to the next level, yeah. The final level. So now we see a TV. Man is about to land his ass on the moon. Now, this is like my favorite part, because first of all, you get to like see and realize how young society is at this point, mm-hmm. How young these girls are, how monumental like things were when they really like penetrated society, like, yeah, a like fucking when things moon happened, landing.
Everybody watched the moon landing. Yeah, it wasn't like today where there's 500 cable channels. And
then, as I wrote in my notes, and I don't really mean this, but as they're watching this, Charles Manson starts to make some goddamn sense. Let's cut to 42:28 to 44:57. This is how I like introduce myself at parties.
Moonwalk's fake.
It is?
It's a government PR stunt. Make the country forget about poverty in Vietnam when what they ought to be doing is preparing for Helter Skelter. Blackie's revolt against the white man. And if Blackie don't start the revolution himself, we're going to start it for him, right?
Uh-huh. Right on.
That's one small step for man.
You're my soldiers.
Pardon? Sire, please.
All of you. Unless you don't believe it. Go to the wall. Stand there. Give me your knife.
I do believe, Charlie, I do.
If you're gonna make others bleed for the cause, you gotta be able to bleed yourself. You think I got good aim? You better pray I do.
I believe, Charlie!
So let it be. Just believe what you see.
Okay.
Intense.
I will say I don't appreciate, as I was about to say during this, him getting a very valid conspiracy, which is that the moon landing was staged. Mixed in with, yes, there was racial tension in America at this time. Certainly not going to be a race war. I don't like all of these things being in the same person's mouth in this movie.
Mixed together.
Leave the moon landing out of this. There's like, this is almost like the government chipped in on this or something. Like they were like, yeah, make sure you like, make sure that the crazy person says that the moon landing's not real. Like, please get out of here. That was like the idea of someone holding the blade of a knife ready to fling it towards my body is like probably more scary than a gun in some ways.
Oh yeah, it's far like, more violent, and
it's also so Russian roulette-y in a way where it's like maybe that's not going to penetrate deep, or if it doesn't, you know what I mean? That it falls off your body, you're just standing there. It sounds terrible. But this man's fucked up, and these women are all beyond. And also, it's very clear now what his agenda is, maybe. He's saying it's these race riots that he's predicting, which, for anyone who doesn't know, the Watts riots were like the biggest riots in L.A., before Rodney King. Like, it was a big, big, big deal. So he's using that to, like, incite fear in these people. It's not unrealistic. They happened 4 years before this happened. So, you know, they're saying, like, you know, he's saying something relative. And by the way, life moved super slow back then. Like, something that happened 4 years ago was still...
was still very much in the current atmosphere then.
For sure.
Now nothing lasts, like, even 2 weeks. Yeah, his those intimidation techniques that he just used, because he just scared her to death.
I'm scared.
Then got them all like laughing about it, like aha, and then he's like, I forgive you.
Yeah, so they're all like flipped out. This is where you get to start to really see them. This is where things change significantly. The weapons and the violence
under his thumb.
Yeah. But there's one quick fight back from your girl Susan, though, which is now Susan's playing an acoustic. She's playing one of Charlie's songs.
Yes.
Tex is listening. The girls are listening. And Charlie comes in and says, when'd you learn my song? You think you can do my song better than me? And he gets really all up in her face. And she's like, no, Charlie, no, I could never. And he's being more and more confrontational. And then finally, the girls are like, basically surrounding him, trying to get him off of her. And he's like, relax, I'm just messing with you. And then he turns to Tex to have a conversation. And you think that Susan is going to, like, walk away. She takes that acoustic and she fucking nails it on the side of a beam and breaks it. And I was like, how many acoustics do you have?
Yeah.
You know, you're was gonna that go the have only
to one? Steal another acoustic.
Yeah. I don't see Charlie, like, sharing and leaving his guitar out. So that must have been, like, a stray. But I really thought if she broke Charlie's guitar, he's going to fucking kill her.
Oh, yeah, he would kill her for sure.
That's exactly what I went to. The children are all crying. They're being kept in this mock jail cell. And we find
hungry.
Out they're starving. And they all look really dirty. And we drive, like, this is where Linda finally is like, I'll handle it. So... she and Susan drive out to Bob Kasabian's place, and she sends Linda takes some air out of the tire, and she sends Susan up to the door. He, you know, answers. He's very like, she's very attractive. Like, it's very porn. What happens? She's got a tire; it's total it needs porn, fixing. Yeah. So he comes out, he fixes it. She invites him to the beach. What he doesn't realize is that Linda is in the trailer now. Stealing $5,000. And she brings it out to the car. They get away before Bob can come back out. She gives Charlie the $5,000 she stole. And he says, this girl came only a few weeks ago. Pause. What? This has been a few weeks? Like, what? Like, Tanya looks a year older. And, like, anyway, so he goes, this girl came only a few weeks ago, but her generosity, her loyalty, this is what I'm talking about. This is what family means. She deserves our gratitude. And I will say Jody and I take exception to his definition of family, because that's not what my family's all about. But everyone's like, thank you so much. And then Susan, who's still on the ice after this acoustic guitar incident, and, like, I don't think he knows that she was part of stealing it. Susan even thanks her. Is like, thank you. So then Bob pulls up. Apparently, he followed them there. Charlie tells everyone to go inside, and he's going to handle this. Now, one thing I want you to keep in mind, like, while you're hearing this scene, is that $5,000 in 1969 is worth $35,400 in today's money. So $5,000 isn't a small sum to me. Like, anyone who thinks $5,000 is not a lot of money is a fucking asshole. But $35,000, like, how desperado would you have to be to get someone out of your life for $35,000? So let's play 5041 to 5206.
She took my money.
What money?
Panhandling must be pretty good. Oh, you Manson?
You must be the man who abandoned our lovely Linda.
Cough it up now, or I'm calling the cops.
Whoa, whoa, hey, there's no need for the pigs, man. We got your money, and you can have it. But you gotta kill me first. Hey, just stick it in. Man, money's yours. So come on. You got what it takes, Bob? You got what it takes to kill a man?
You're crazy.
I never tried to be anything else. So come on. Twist and turn, baby.
You people are out of your minds. You can keep the money. And Linda.
She's one of us. She's not yours to give.
Thank you so much for listening to season 4 of Mother May I Sleep With podcast.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it, or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz. And how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.